years. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for paid year-long news production fellowship. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is your evening news.
Hello. We are Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Our show is on hiatus until May, and until then, we are looking for new members to join the collective. Pacific Underground is the only show by and for Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Pacific Northwest. There is no experience necessary to join, just an enthusiasm for API content and stories through the medium of community radio. If you are Asian or Pacific Islander and are interested in joining, please contact us at pacificunderground@kboo.org, all one word. Or message us on Instagram at PACUnderground.
Cable at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month's screening is Black February on Thursday, February 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Black February chronicles a remarkable series of concerts spanning from funk to symphonic works, providing unique insight into New York's vibrant avant-garde music scene. Again, that's Black February on Thursday, February 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland's 10-cent gas tax will need reapproval from voters on the May ballot.
Trump properties charge U.S. Secret Service agents as much as $650 per night to protect the president.
And protesters gathered today at the Port of Vancouver to rally against the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion project. We'll hear from one of the organizers.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 7th, 2020. I'm Andrew Geller.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. Portland's gas tax will be up for renewal on the May primary election ballot. The 10 cents per gallon tax was originally passed in 2016, and the money raised has funded street repairs and improvements by the Portland Bureau of Transportation. On Thursday, City Council unanimously referred the measure to the upcoming ballot. City Commissioner Chloe Udaly, who oversees PBOT, said of the measure, quote, "It's well worth the dime we pay at the pump," end quote. Since its passage, the tax has raised $64 million, and PBOT has used the funds to pave or improve 40 miles of road. They've constructed 300 new ramps to meet ADA standards and updated 58 intersections for safety, among other projects. Transportation officials have prepared a $74 million list of projects it would tackle if the tax were to be reenacted. City Council is also expected to renew a heavy vehicle use tax for businesses, which would raise another $11 million. The Fixing Our Street program, as it is called, is also connected to Vision Zero Portland, a PBOT initiative to reduce the number of traffic-related deaths. In 2019, 49 people died in Portland in traffic-related incidents, the highest death toll since 1997. If voters pass the gas tax in May, it will last until 2024.
The Trump Organization charges the Secret Service exorbitant rates to protect the president when he travels to his own properties, according to a new report from the Washington Post. An investigation into federal records shows Trump charged U.S. taxpayers up to $650 per night for agent lodging at the Mar-a-Lago Resort dozens of times in 2017 and $400 per night dozens of times in 2018. The Secret Service also paid $17,000 per month for a three-bedroom cottage for agents when Trump traveled to his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. The investigation reviewed charges between January of 2017 and April of 2018. Taxpayers shelled out $471,000 to Trump properties during those 16 months, an average of almost $1,000 every day. The grand total is likely much higher, as this investigation covers less than half of Trump's time in office. No other president has charged the U.S. Secret Service for lodging at their own properties. It also directly contradicts a statement made by Eric Trump in 2019 that his father does not charge the Secret Service for lodging at his hotels. These revelations are a reminder of Trump's refusal to divest from his businesses when he took office, and numerous other instances when the president directed official business to his own properties for the purpose of profit. Trump has spent approximately one-third of his term staying at his own properties.
Over 150 protesters gathered at the Port of Vancouver today to rally against the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion project in Canada. Since the fall, materials for the pipeline's construction have been shipped into the Port of Vancouver, drawing protests for the pipeline's role in the climate crisis. The Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion would transport tar sands oil across Canada from the Alberta tar sands to the shores of British Columbia, which activists oppose for a few reasons. For one, the emissions from such a project would be severe, and the pipeline would cross considerable amounts of Indigenous land, creating risk for their local waters and way of life. Protesters are demanding the resignation of the CEO of the Port of Vancouver for their role in the shipment and the storage of pieces of the project. KBOO's Althea Billings spoke with Rachel Walsh, an organizer with the grassroots group Portland Rising Tide.
My name is Rachel Walsh, and I organize with Portland Rising Tide. We're a grassroots group, and we're part of an international network of Rising Tide groups.
And tell me about the protest that was going on today.
Yeah, so today, Portland Rising Tide, along with a coalition of grassroots organizations and community members, went out to the Port of Vancouver, Washington, and we delivered a resignation letter for Port CEO Juliana Marler to sign because she has failed us in terms of leadership on climate and human rights by allowing pipe for the Trans Mountain Expansion tar sands pipeline to be shipped through the Port of Vancouver. This is the third action that Portland Rising Tide and other groups have done at the port in recent months. In October, we actually went out and blocked the pipe, a shipment of the pipe by rail. And then we went back in November and we blocked it on the water. We actually went out with about 20 kayakers, and we also had climbers climb on the port, and we blocked the tanker ship Patagonia that was delivering the pipe from India to the Port of Vancouver. So we blocked it twice, and this time we brought a bunch of community members out. We had about 150 community members join us today. And we went to confront the Port Commission office directly and demand the resignation of the CEO. And even though it's a public port, they wouldn't even let us come inside. They sent their security out to block us from entering. But we delivered our message loud and clear that we need stronger leadership on climate and for human rights.
And so, tell me, has the port committed to any kind of action on this pipeline in particular?
So, recently the port has put out statements saying that they're in favor of renewable energy and climate solutions. They've said that they want to be a leader on climate, and they have agreed to not build new fossil fuel terminals at the port. But they haven't made any statements about not allowing infrastructure for fossil fuel expansion or tar sands, which is the dirtiest fossil fuel extraction that exists today. They haven't made any commitments to stopping this destructive infrastructure from moving through the port. So we, as a community, are saying that's not enough. We can't just have business as usual. We need stronger leadership. And we're putting pressure on them to take a bolder stance in support of a livable climate future and for Indigenous sovereignty and human rights.
And what would be the consequence if the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion project were to go forward?
Right. So there are a number of destructive consequences if the Trans Mountain expansion Tarzan's pipeline is built. A big issue is that it's a violation of Indigenous sovereignty. And actually, on Tuesday of this week, the Canadian Federal Court of Appeals actually issued a ruling against Native tribes that sued, stating that they did not get adequately consulted before the Canadian government approved the pipeline project. And so they actually lost that lawsuit on Tuesday. The Canadian court ruled against the Indigenous tribes. However, there's still a lawsuit pending in the Supreme Court of Canada. They are most likely going to continue on with the lawsuit that they lost on Tuesday in the Supreme Court as well. And leaders from these tribal groups, which include the Tsleil-Waututh, the Squamish, and the Coldwater Band, have all pledged that they will take direct action and engage in civil disobedience if needed in order to stop the pipeline project. So today we sent a strong message to the Port of Vancouver, USA, that we need stronger climate leadership. We need stronger leadership on human rights. And we are going to be back. We're going to continue fighting the TMX pipe as it moves up to Canada. And up in Canada, there are a lot of frontline groups who are going to continue opposing this project. We want to send a strong message that this fight isn't over and that people all up and down the coast of the Pacific Northwest are going to keep fighting it. And there are a lot of ways to get involved in supporting these fights. You can donate to Pull Together, which is a coalition of Indigenous groups that are fighting this project in the courts. You can also donate to the Unistoten and the Wet'suwet'en. You can donate to Unistoten Camp, and that would support their efforts in preventing the Coastal GasLink pipeline from moving to their territory. You can get in touch locally with Portland Rising Tide or a number of climate groups if you want to get involved.
Very cool. Well, thank you for speaking with me, Rachel.
All right, thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Althea Billings.
In the continuing murder trial of Jeremy Christian, the defense team sought to have certain charges dropped, and the prosecution rested their case yesterday. Christian is accused of killing two people and injuring a third person in a stabbing attack on a Portland light rail train in May 2017. Based on certain wording differences between the two indictments of first-degree murder, Christian's defense team has argued that because one seems to define the chronological order of events, one of the indictments is invalid and should be dropped. Jeff Howes, first assistant to the district attorney, said, quote, "The defense is stridently trying to put a very fine point on a couple of words. I understand the argument, but I don't think it holds water," unquote. Judge Cheryl Albrecht said she would read up on the case law and make a ruling at another time. The defense also sought to have the charges of intimidation against the two young black women on the train dropped. The question is whether the effect of Christian's racial harassment and Islamophobic comments rise to the level of physical threat to the young women. The prosecution rested Wednesday afternoon, and jurors will return Monday to hear the beginning of the defense's case.
Oregon Food Bank is mobilizing its statewide network to ensure every Oregonian is counted in this year's census. As Eric Tegahoff reports, about 10% of Oregon's population lives in neighborhoods that are considered difficult to count for the next census.
This is the first time Oregon Food Bank is taking part in census outreach efforts. Ray Dunneville with the organization says they're in prime position to do so because they interact with about 72,000 community members each month. Dunneville says they are supporting service organizations like food banks with education on the importance of the census, training, and translating material.
We're also providing folks with the ability to do the census right on site. So we're helping by offering technology, laptops, support with volunteers.
Dunneville notes 40,000 volunteers help Oregon Food Bank each year. The organization also is partnering with We Count Oregon to assist historically undercounted populations. That includes children, communities of color, students, and renters. Oregon's food bank network reaches into Southwest Washington, where it is also doing outreach. Dunneville says an accurate count will mean Oregonians get the resources they need, which is in line with Oregon Food Bank's mission to eliminate the root causes of hunger. She says the state receives $3,200 per person per year from the federal government for assistance programs based on census numbers.
That's a lot of resources that are really needed to continue making sure that programs like SNAP and WIC and Section 8 housing and school meals continue to have the funding that they need as our state grows.
In the past decade, an estimated 450,000 people have moved to Oregon. About 10% of the population lives in areas considered hard to count. By April 1st, households across Oregon will receive invitations to participate in the census. They can respond online, by phone, or by mail. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin with Janine Jackson. At 6 p.m., it's Rising Up with Sonali, and then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather will be rainy and cool. Tomorrow will be the same, but a little bit warmer. Today in history, back in 1991, Haiti's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was sworn in. Today's quote is from him. Quote, "We shall prepare the coffee of reconciliation through the filter of justice. Through reconciliation, streams of tears will come to our eyes."
On Monday, many Iowans experienced well-run caucuses, but their results, on the other hand, weren't so well-run. And Iowa's Democrats say chaos was partially caused by calls from Trump supporters clogging the lines. With that story and more, here's Lily Bulkley with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process. Tonight's the New Hampshire Democratic debate at St. Anselm College, but the trail of criticism leveled at Iowa Democrats this week won't abate anytime soon. Was it a bad app developer that ruined rapid reporting, lack of sufficient testing and backup systems by state Democrats, or an unexpected amount of mischief sabotaging the one backup the local party had? The national narrative doesn't sit well with caucus-goer Carol Horowitz from Ames.
We're being demeaned and minimized, and we shouldn't. We did our civic duty. We went to the polls in Ames, all the precinct heads. They said it went like clockwork. It was wonderful. It was communication, and it's not Iowa's fault or the Iowans' fault.
Iowa Democrats say that contributing to the chaos was an unusually high volume of calls, including from President Trump's supporters. NBC News reported that the backup reporting phone number was posted on 4chan, a right-wing internet messaging board encouraging people to, quote, clog the lines, unquote. Yesterday, after inconsistencies continued to be found in the 97% of reported results, DNC Chair Tom Perez called for the Iowa Democratic Party to begin a re-canvass of the paper trail. Iowa Democratic Chair Troy Price responded that one of the candidates has to request that. Independent news website Shadowproof.com's Kevin Gastola pointed out the confusion with Iowa's numbers.
Nobody in the United States would understand what people in Iowa are doing to come up with these numbers. I mean, it has worked for people in the Iowa State Democratic Party, clearly, but to the outside observer, this doesn't make sense.
Drake University professor Dennis Goldford is clear on what he believes the numbers do tell us.
We clearly know that Buttigieg had a strong showing, Sanders had a strong showing. We saw that Biden did not have a strong showing. The Klobuchar surge did not really appear. And Warren, who had led at one point in polls, she didn't have a poor night, but she didn't have a wonderful night either. Now that's basically all swallowed up in the coverage of the New Hampshire primary.
But many eyes are already on the Nevada debate later this month. The DNC's rule change drops the individual donor requirement in favor of just a polling threshold. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says the change largely benefits former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, whose campaign isn't accepting any individual donations.
He's not on the ballot, I guess, in Nevada. or South Carolina, but he's worth $55 billion. And I guess if you're worth $55 billion, you can get the rules changed for debate.
Kevin Gustola brought up other past and current candidates who've been excluded from debate stages.
Imagine if the rule had been changed for them so that they could be on the stage. That would have been tremendously helpful for their campaigns and their uphill battle against some of the stronger presidential campaigns.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Wolke. Thanks to Kevin Bowe for sound from New Hampshire, and thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Tonight, candidates for the Democratic nomination for president will face off once more in the final debate ahead of the New Hampshire primary. Seven candidates participated this evening, including contested Iowa caucus winners Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Joining them are former Vice President Joe Biden, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, Tom Steyer, and Andrew Yang. Biden supporters will be looking to see if their candidate still has a viable chance after a disappointing show in Iowa. Despite that performance in Iowa, Biden still leads in polls on the question of who voters are considering supporting, though Sanders is close behind. Warren came in third in Iowa, but is polling fourth in New Hampshire. For Klobuchar, Yang, and Steyer, the debate stage could be a place to do some catching up to the main four candidates. The debate started at 5 p.m. and is expected to end around 9.
Key impeachment witness Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman has been fired from his job in the White House. Vindman was a top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council and has been pushed out of his role months earlier than he was expected to. Vindman was slated to leave in July, but today he was escorted out of the White House by security and told his services were no longer needed. Vindman is a decorated veteran who was born in Ukraine, and under subpoena, he testified in the House impeachment investigation against President Trump. The National Security Council declined to comment on the matter. Vindman's attorney, David Pressman, said in a statement, quote, "There is no question in the mind of any American why this man's job is over, why this country now has one less soldier serving it at the White House. Vindman was asked to leave for telling the truth. His honor, his commitment to right, frightened the powerful," end quote. Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland has also been fired today. Sondland also testified in the House impeachment investigation that he believed the White House held military aid for Ukraine in exchange for an investigation into Trump's political rival.
Police are moving in on demonstrators opposing the Coastal GasLink project in northern British Columbia. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, a daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In British Columbia, Canada, arrests are being made at a demonstration site on Wet'suwet'en territory. The CBC reports people are camped out near an access road in opposition of construction of a natural gas pipeline. Hereditary chiefs have said no to the project, and talks with the provincial government have reportedly broke down. Conflict over the project has lasted years. A court ordered people to stop preventing workers access to the area. Police announced Wednesday they would enforce an injunction. Demonstrators are taking to social media, saying they're prepared for police action. The Coastal GasLink pipeline is a $6 billion project, which supporters say will create jobs and boost the economy. In a first of its kind for a tribal college, an international exchange program is in the works for Haskell Indian Nations University and a Maori university in New Zealand. Educators recently met in Lawrence, Kansas to work on an agreement. Rhonda Lavaldo has more.
Efforts to establish advanced degree programs and more research opportunities, Haskell in Lawrence, Kansas met with Chief Executive Officer of the Maori Indigenous University in New Zealand. The CEO, Weremu Dori, met with administration and students to discuss the possibilities of starting an exchange program and what they could learn from each other.
Our connections here in the US with the different nations that have a history very, very similar to ours. Talk about the issues that were challenging, but more importantly, look at the things that we want to do and around the aspirations of where we want to be, and then by us working together, collaborating together, That place where we want to be is that much more achievable if we're doing it together.
Alan Parker, a Chippewa Cree from Montana and faculty at the Maury University, talked about the impact of taking students down to be the first cohort.
In 2019, the first two of that group received their PhD. So it's just a powerful experience. And the potential is just wonderful.
Haskell Interim President Daniel Wildcat says a memorandum of understanding is being written that he hopes to be signed within a couple of months. Haskell currently does not offer any graduate degree programs. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
Approval has been given for a solar project on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, as Roz Brown reports.
The Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in southwestern South Dakota will be the site of a $100 million solar electricity generation project. The state's Public Utilities Commission approved the Lookout Solar Park this week for property about 80 miles from Rapid City. To build the state's first large-scale solar facility, a German company will lease the land from the Rapp family. Lynn Rapp is a member of the Ogallala Sioux tribe who has represented the family and hopes the historic project will be an example for other reservations.
And then we know that when a dollar is spent, it turns over seven times in the community where it is used, and our reservation towns are desperate for cash.
The lease agreement is the first of its kind for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The company involved to build the solar project has agreed to follow 37 conditions during construction related to restoration, threatened and endangered species, cultural resources reporting, and other requirements. The Pine Ridge project, capable of generating up to 110 megawatts of electricity, will have 500,000 solar panels in arrays across 250 acres. Rapp says there's more than 800 acres at the site, and eventually she'd also like to see a wind farm built there. The solar facility is expected to be complete by the second quarter of 2021. I'm Roz Brown.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Virginia House of Delegates voted yesterday to end a holiday commemorating two major generals of the Confederacy, Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. Both owned slaves and fought to protect slavery in the Civil War. Lee Jackson Day will be replaced with an Election Day holiday intended to help more Virginians get out to vote. Lee Jackson Day had been observed the Friday before Martin Luther King Jr. Day in January, and supporters of the holiday said it honors history. However, that is an argument that has fallen out of favor. That shift has been evidenced by an ongoing fight in Virginia and other southern states to remove Confederate monuments. Last April, a Virginia judge ruled that the status of Lee and Jackson in Charlottesville were, quote, war monuments, end quote, that the city couldn't remove without permission from the state. The decision is likely to be appealed, and in the meantime, the statues have been shrouded as a memorial for the death of Heather Heyer, a counter-protester at the 2017 Unite the Right rally, who was killed when an avowed neo-Nazi drove a car through the crowd. Confederate Memorial Day is still a statutory holiday in Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, and two of those states combine the holiday with Martin Luther King birthday. The bill in the House of Delegates is nearly identical to one passed by the Virginia Senate, but the two chambers will have to agree on a final version before Governor Northam can sign it into law.
With a divisive impeachment trial now over, public parks advocates hope Congress can focus on an issue with bipartisan support, national parks. Eric Tegedoff has more.
The Restore Our Parks and Public Lands Act would fund repairs sorely needed in the country's national park system. Deferred maintenance costs are nearly $12 billion, according to the National Park Service. Head of Recreation Northwest Todd Ellsworth says Washington State is fortunate to have three parks, but overdue repairs are a roadblock.
When they get to these places and there's deficiencies in infrastructure and roads and bridges and other parts that make really the park accessible and safe for everyone, that's where we're really seeing some challenges.
National parks are a big economic driver in Washington. In 2018, they saw more than 8 million visitors who spent more than $500 million in gateway communities and generated nearly 6,000 jobs. However, repair costs in the state are nearly $428 million. Marcia Argus is director of the Pew Charitable Trust Restore America's National Parks campaign. She says at a time when Washington, D.C. is so polarized, this is legislation that can move forward.
It's supported by over half of Senate members and over three-quarters of the House members. And it's also supported by the administration.
Ellsworth adds that addressing the maintenance backlog is becoming more important as the state's population grows at a rapid pace and puts more strain on parks.
I believe that one of the reasons that people are moving here, not just for the tech jobs in other sectors, but it's the access to the outdoors that so many of us yearn for and appreciate, and it's part of the Washington experience.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 7th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegehoff, Lily Boakley, and Antonio Gonzalez. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Andrew Geller. Coming up next is Counterspin, and don't forget that it's almost time to plant your tomato and pepper seeds inside.